Good morning, good evening, and good afternoon. My name is Staff Sergeant Sam McCroll of the North Dakota National Guard's Public Affairs Office. We had a very special opportunity to interview now retired Major General Alan Dorman. This interview and podcast episode will be a little bit different. Basically, I'll ask the question and then you'll hear a pre-recorded interview with General Dorman. So, with that being said, let's get right into it. What inspired you to serve in the military?
I always go back to when I was a young child. Was always fascinated with military service. There are veterans in my church from the World War II era. Back then, there was still a tank and an airplane on a stick outside the elementary school, but it always intrigued me. But I think what really got me to the point where I was interested is I worked at a Boy Scout camp for years, and two of the guys I worked with, one was going into the Army, ended up being a Green Beret. The other one was going to the Air Force. And I thought, hey, I want to fly planes. I think I was in my second or third year of college, and just decided I was going to join ROTC. I was going to go to the University of Minnesota because I was going to Mankato State. They didn't have ROTC when I had left school the previous spring. But when I went back to school to disenroll, I saw an ROTC sign up. So I went there. It was Army, not Air Force, but they said, hey, if you want to fly helicopters, come join us. So I did. I never flew helicopters, but graduating from college in 1983, didn't really know what I wanted to do, so I decided, hey, I'll just go into the Army, see how I like that.
What was the beginning of your career like?
Platoon leader, I still think, is the best job in the Army. I don't have the world's best social skills, but I can tell you, it was the last time I knew every single one of my soldiers, personally. And it was just an incredible learning experience. You know, in college, I wasn't real active on ROTC. I knew a lot of the cadre there because I bartended at the bar they all went to. So I had a great relationship with the enlisted cadre at the ROTC program. And that, I think, gave me a great appreciation for enlisted leadership. And that's a lesson I learned right away. I came in as a second lieutenant, and I'm like, hey, somebody made a horrible mistake. I'm in charge of 30-some people, all this equipment, armored personnel carriers, weapons. I'm in way over my head. But my first platoon sergeant had done a couple of tours in Vietnam as Marine, got out, joined the Army. Kind of a crusty NCO. I would show up and he'd say, Lieutenant, your desk is over there. And then didn't talk to me for like the first 4 hours. And then when he finally did, he said, hey, we're going to Grafenbeer in a couple of weeks for our annual range qualifications and on to Hohensfeld for our external evaluation. We'll run the ranges. That's NCO work. You take care of the eyewash in case the battalion commander came along. And the eyewash is a little stand you have with, all the administrative stuff and the eyewash, literally. But, he really reinforced the roles of the NCO and the officer. And that paid dividends like within a year because the first sergeant had gone home on emergency leave. My platoon sergeant got elevated to be acting first sergeant, but I think he had laid the foundation of what do officers do, what do NCOs do, how important that relationship was, and that really got me off to a good start.
How did your military career bring you to the North Dakota National Guard?
When I got commissioned, I wanted to fly helicopters. I had a guaranteed flight contract. A good friend of mine was a secretary to the professor of military science at University of Minnesota. Mankato was a satellite program. I had managed to screw up an ROTC scholarship, but I still had my guaranteed flight contract, which meant when I went into the Army, I would be a helicopter pilot. But without the scholarship, I was looking at all this money on flights courses. And so I called my friend up and says, hey, I don't know what to do. And she told me, you know what, they only gave two of these out in the entire Western United States. So the fact that you got one of these guaranteed flight contracts, I would say, bodes well for you getting branched aviation after you commission. Commissioning time, I get my branch and it's infantry. Well, aviation wasn't a branch yet. That didn't happen for a couple more years. So you went infantry first, and then you went down to what's Novicello now, used to be Fort Rucker, for flight school. So professor of military science and me, we get on the phone. It's like, well, it says infantry, but obviously this means infantry, then flight school. And they said, no, just infantry. And if I had ranked order the branches I wanted to go into, I think infantry would have been near the bottom. But then when I got into the branch, and it was just so cool working as a team at that level. So of course the Army figured out that I really liked being an infantry officer. So at the end of my first 3 years, you had to go through a rebranch process. And the Army decided with my low MASS scores that Signal Corps would be a good branch for me to go into. So I left Germany, went to Augusta, Georgia for a Signal Officer Advanced course. I wanted to get out there in the worst way, so I applied to go to the Q course for Special Forces. I got my orders for the Q course. I'm training, I'm getting ready. It's probably a month before I'm supposed to go up to Fort Liberty to start the Q course. But right then, I always had this problem with new branches. Right then, Special Forces became a branch. They weren't a branch before. Like aviation, you had another base branch and then you went to SF. But you never removed your base branch. So I call up the SF branch manager. He says, not a problem. We're expanding Special Forces. I'll just run down the hall to the signal officer, branch manager, and get you transferred to Special Forces. He goes down there. The branch manager says, not only no, but heck no, because I wasn't a captain yet, and my branch transfer to Signal Corps didn't take effect till I was promoted to captain, which was like a month away. And he says, I can't let somebody go that we don't even have yet. It would set a horrible example. So I didn't get, my Q course orders were rescinded, but my next assignment was the 1st Battalion, 1st Special Forces Group in Okinawa, Japan. So I went there not as a Special Forces qualified officer, but as a signal officer running the signal center for the battalion. And at first, I'm like, this is going to blow. But really enjoyed it. It's funny, the two friends that I had at Boy Scout camp in the early 80s, when I got to the airport in Okinawa, one of the guys that used to work at the beach with me picked me up at the airport. And then the next weekend, I went to the officers' club. And my other buddy who was going into the Air Force, I walk into the O Club and he's there. He's an F-15 pilot flying out of Kadena. And then when I checked into the unit, a guy I didn't know well, but he used to be the camp ranger that took care of all the logistics. He's the one that signed me into the unit. So we had four people from Tomahawk Scout Reservation in Rice Lake, Wisconsin, in the early 80s. All in the 1st Battalion, 1st Special Forces Group in Okinawa, Japan. And I just had a great experience there. And I never got out of the signal branch. I tried, but you know, they just weren't gonna have it. But it was at that point, it's like, well, I had fun in the infantry. When I was in the Special Forces unit as a signal officer, I still got to jump out of airplanes and my buddy would take me along if they did like rubber boat operations or something. So I got to do a lot of cool things, and I'm like, you know, this is what I want in the Army, to do this cool stuff. I can't do that anymore. I'm going to get out. Decided that I was going to go to law school. I never got very good grades, so I'm like, well, we'll see where I get in. I got in at Hamline University in University of North Dakota, and UND was about a third the cost of Hamline, so that's what brought me to North Dakota. That's where I met my wife. She's pretty fond of North Dakota, so it was clear to me that, you know, North Dakota is probably my home. But it was in law school I met Kevin Chapman, who's a second lieutenant with the 141 in Valley City. And he said, hey, we got an opening for a captain. You want to come join us? And I'm like, well, I've been infantry, I've been signal corps, but you know, it's an engineer unit. I don't have much to offer. But they said they would take me. They were a little reluctant. They didn't like bringing back then. They didn't like bringing in folks from active duty. But joined the unit in Valley City. They told me I would never make major. So jokes on them, I made it. But that's what brought me to North Dakota. And the experience in Valley City was interesting. I went to my first AT like a week after I joined. And I was in the ops, I was in the S3 section. I sat in a tent all day with a man named Larry Hovel, who was a very technically proficient NCO. And he would do a lot of their engineer planning, and I was supposed to help him. I didn't know what I was doing. So it was the longest AT of my life. At one point, the S3 finally said, well, Dorman, you're pretty good at road marches because you were mech infantry and all that. Go evaluate our road march. And I went out, evaluated this unit's road march. I came back to the commander's update brief that night. The S3 told me to brief. I told them pretty much everything that was wrong. But I never said we, I said you, because I really didn't feel like I was part of the unit yet. And so my initial engagement with the National Guard in North Dakota was not very positive. And it was on me. I mean, to say you didn't do this right, you didn't do that right, and I'm part of the unit, just didn't play well. But after that, I did make some good friends, met some great people. One of them was Mike Aberly, and he got transferred from the 141 up to the military academy. Nobody knew what to do with me, and at one of our officer management boards, I think it was Greg Wills, said, hey, we'll take Dorman up at Camp Grafton with the military academy, now the RTI. I got up there. We had OCS consolidation in North Dakota, I think, the next year. And that's where I met Greg Wills. That's where I met Dave Spritznatic, who was my commander up there. That's the first time I probably had a chance to show folks what I was capable of doing, because I said I was in an engineer unit with no engineer skills. So I mean, it was really hard to shine if you don't have any actual skills. But yeah, moving up to the RTI really got my career going in the National Guard.
What roles were challenging and how did they shape you?
Well, this will sound like a lawyer's answer, but all of them are really challenging. I mean, the one thing I learned early on was that you'll never feel fully prepared for whatever's next. That's how you develop leaders. You put them into new situations. You grow most from the things that scare you. My first platoon, I was like I said, I mean, somebody made a horrible mistake putting me in charge of this. I eventually got the scout platoon, which was like the premier platoon, and I'm like, yeah, I'm not the best guy here, but okay, I'll give it a go. And then even going to Okinawa, I mean, I'm hanging out with all these special operators, and I'm like, they're going to discover me as a fraud early on. But it's that challenge, and I share with folks, I ride an indoor bike in the wintertime. I'm a bike rider, and that's how I stay in shape over the wintertime. And I was watching a Mike Rowe podcast, and Jay Leno was the guest. And Mike was complimenting Jay, said, hey, I saw you on the set of Leno's Garage interacting with your staff. You were very supportive. You showed up early. You stayed late. You didn't micromanage. You sought their input. Says I was very impressed. And Jay said, well, I'm a big fan of low self-esteem. And Mike went, amen, or something, and agreed with him. And it kind of clicked for me, because that's how I feel. You know, low self-esteem isn't a bad thing if you have the curiosity and the drive to figure out what it is you don't know, to build relationships so that you can trust the subject matter experts are going to support you. As you gain more rank and more responsibility, you know, the idea that I'm an expert in everything the North Dakota National Guard does, you know, is not true. I talk to these young soldiers and they tell me what they do, and I'm like, yeah, you got to dumb that down. I don't understand what you're telling me. But, you know, those are the challenges. You know, a big one for me was when I was selected to be the commanding general for K4 12. I had been to Kosovo once before, so that was a huge advantage that I'd actually been on the ground. I'd seen another unit. That one was based out of Ohio, but you have units from, you know, 20, 30 different states over there, plus two multinational battalions underneath you. So that's the first time I had like the big leadership challenge at a high rank. But again, I think I go back to having the low self-esteem to know you don't know everything, getting curious about what you need to do to get ready for that. I remember Dan Murphy was my public affairs officer, and he asked me before we even left North Dakota, he says, you know, are you ever scared that you're not up for this? And I'm like, yeah, every single day. But, you know, I dug into the books. Some of the stuff they told me I should have read the first time I was there, but it was super boring. I didn't read it. This time I read it. And then, you know, you have to trust your gut. Whatever position you're in, somebody put a lot of thought into whether you're the right person for that job or not. And it's interesting when you're at the end of the table and you got to make all these decisions, especially in the train up, because they try to pack a week into every day. But yeah, that training works. You get comfortable, you get more decisive, you make mistakes. I'm a big fan of when you make a mistake, immediately own up to it and fix it. Because everybody knows you made a mistake. You know, you're not, I remember as an infantry platoon leader, I marched my guys in the middle of the night up the wrong mountain and then had to go back down. I had to pass each and every one of them and look them in the eye on the way down. You know, you don't have to pretend like you didn't make a mistake. They all saw you make a mistake.
How did you build a team?
Putting the right people in the right spots. I think it was Jim Collins said, get the right people on the bus, but you're not done there, then you got to get them in the right seats. And every leader's different. Kosovo, I was lucky. I had great support from General Spritznatic. And, you know, the story of the MEB going to Kosovo was the 34th Engineer Brigade was deactivated. So everybody in the 34th Engineer Brigade formed the core of the 141 MEB. But as soon as they moved all those people in the MEB, the 34th got lit up for Iraq. So they went back over to the 34th. They went to Iraq. Now you got this empty unit called the 141 MEB. And what does the Army do? Lights it up for Kosovo. So when the MEB got sourced for Kosovo, there was nobody in it. So literally over the course of a year, I brought in some of the key leaders first, but we were able to build that whole headquarters from scratch. And there are great people throughout the organization, but it takes a while to get your team in place. And in Kosovo, I had the opportunity to really build the team and train. And there's no history of a prior commander. There's no history of we used to do it this way because there was no history for the unit. And General Spritznatic basically said, you can take whoever you want. We emptied the headquarters, full-time site. I don't know how they function back here for 12 months while we're gone, because we had so many of the full-time support staff that went with us to Kosovo. But that was a luxury to be able to build your own headquarters. When I came in as adjutant general, General Spritznadek had a great staff working for him, but they were kind of his staff. It'll take some time to build your team. At a lower level, obviously you gotta do it quick, because you may only have a year or two as a platoon leader or a company commander or a battalion commander. As the adjutant general, it takes a little longer to put that team together. But I would say within a year or two, really was able to get the folks in place that understood my vision, where I wanted to go. And I think after that, things really started to click.
How did your career prepare you to lead during domestic emergency operations in the state?
My ability to do what I do is the same reason that MPs and combat engineers and CSTs and others can take their military acquired skills and go fix a problem. You know, last spring, ice jam in the Missouri River. And we go to all the things that we've done in the past, put, you know, dark stuff on it and the sun will radiate it and melt the ice quicker. Well, that wasn't gonna work. We had been putting that stuff on the ice for 6 months, and you know, the ice would probably have melted by July. But bringing that team together that has these military acquired skills, have been in stressful situations, have worked with diverse teams, sometimes multinational teams or multi-service teams, but being able to bring those folks together to quickly problem solve, come up with solutions. Some of them fail, like putting dark dust on ice and hope it melts, but then you just keep talking and then ideas come up. And like the Missouri River, my idea was to put a bucket underneath the helicopter, fill it up with water, and then sledgehammer the ice. And the pilots told me that's a dumb idea. That's not going to work. But then the pilots came back and said, what if we dropped the water and tried to punch a hole through the ice with the weight of the water? And I'm like, okay. No idea if that would work. There's no doctrine on that. You don't train to do that. But we gave it a try. And for a couple hours, we had no success. And then the pilots just kept iterating. And, you know, they dropped from 100 feet down to 80 feet. And all of a sudden, boom, it punched through the ice. And then once they punched through the ice, you could kind of see where the seams were that you could exploit. And I think in the first 3 hours, we broke loose a 20 square foot section of ice. By probably 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there are sheets of ice the size of football fields going down the river. But it's, you know, that's, you know, we were trained to form teams, to get after a problem, and we keep going until we find a solution. And so those same skill sets work when you have, you know, novel experiences, like, you know, thousands of protesters on the prairie in southern Morton County. I mean, who would envision that ever happening? Well, it happened. And just like everything else you do, you form the team. The hard part for me is getting the right people in the right seats, empowering them to get after the job at hand. Knowing that they're the ones probably with the expertise and in many cases the creativity to figure out what a solution might be. I got to empower them. I got to go find the resources they need to get the job done, and then cut them loose. And with the National Guard and with DES too, if you cut them loose, they'll amaze you. And I think during the pipeline protests, during the pandemic, during some of these natural disasters we've had, the team has really done a great job.
How have you seen the National Guard change during your military career?
The Guard that I joined in 1991 was already changing. When I was in Okinawa, we did an unconventional warfare exercise, And I think a bunch of California guardsmen got voluntold to go to Okinawa and live in the jungle for 6 weeks. They were not happy. They were supposed to act like native fighters being trained by U.S. forces. But again, they were training aides. They were not happy. My opinion of the guard was, and then I moved to North Dakota, like I said. My buddy got me into the guard. My first AT, I was impressed with some of the capability of the soldiers. There was some great people in leadership, but, you know, soldiers are fairly easy to train. That collective leadership piece is hard. You know, that's why they send you to a mob station for weeks and months, because getting the command and control element trained up and ready to go at the battalion and brigade level, that takes time if you don't do it on a regular basis. And with, you know, a weekend a month and 2 weeks in summer, there is no way to train that collective piece to that level. But then, you know, we went to Bosnia, we went to Kosovo. The performance of those units, you know, at the company level and below was outstanding. Then 9/11 happened. And at first the Army was, I think, wanted more of our small units, but early on they needed some big units. And it was amazing to see the capability of our, not only of our soldiers, but of our leadership teams and our company and battalion headquarters when they had time to train on it, get proficient on it, they could match anybody on active duty. So, you know, that was a big change, that were every bit as capable as the active component, in many cases more capable because of the civilian acquired skills we bring to the fight. I'm always amazed that we have some traditional guardsmen that maybe don't come to our attention. We're like, yeah, they're nice, they seem good, but I don't know. But, you know, they got a civilian job, they're raising a family, they're doing this guard thing on top of all that. And then you take all this away temporarily and give them one job to do, and that's be an officer, an NCO in the National Guard, and just blow you away. So we got great people. When we had the time to train, we're on par with anybody out there. But, you know, with the war, with the repeated deployments, I think the culture changed a little bit too. Everybody that enlisted or re-enlisted after 9/11 did so to go do stuff. They knew they were going to go do stuff. Frankly, I'm concerned if the operational tempo ever went down, as every time we have a unit alerted and we need to put additional soldiers in there because the unit's not at full strength, we always have more volunteers than we need to fill the unit. So I think it's important that we keep the operational guard going forward. I don't really think there's a risk of that, because with the active duties recruiting challenges, with budget challenges, it seems to me that we probably have to do more with the National Guard, because we are much more cost effective than the active component. And we've demonstrated for over 20 years now that you can give us any mission and nobody's going to know the difference between, or they're not going to know if you're a guard unit or an active unit. Once you get on the ground, you're just a U.S. Army soldier, U.S. Air Force airman, getting the job done.
How did you balance family life with your military career? And what advice do you have for young soldiers and airmen?
Not very well, and figure it out. Do it better than I did. First, if you have a great life partner, that helps a lot. And my wife actually is a retired guardsman. When I met her, her father and all six children were in the Air Guard in Fargo. Which helped me out a lot, because when I became adjutant general, and even before that, had a pretty good relationship with the Air National Guard, because I think I was related to 0.05% of all members, so that gave me a leg up on my Air Guard relationships. And, you know, General Spritznatic was a good mentor in this regard. I remember a couple times a year he had a week blocked off, and they went skiing or they went to the lake, and those were never violated. You're gone. I don't care what's happening. Somebody else will cover because he's going to the lake or he's going skiing. So I started doing that, and that helped. But again, you know, the having a great life partner helps. Being present when you're there. I got better as time because my wife forced me to do more family vacations and activities. But, you know, it's tough. You know, we always thank the families and, you know, the spouses, especially heavy burden for them. But the kids, too. Whenever we send off or welcome home a unit, I usually recognize the kids. I don't know what they're going through because I didn't go through that when I was a kid. But having one of your parents gone for a year at a time or weeks at a time, even for school, you know, has an impact. I remember, his former chairman of the Joint Chief, General Dempsey. Is that one of my general officer education programs? And somebody says, you know, general, how do I balance work and family and all this stuff? And Dempsey went, I don't know, you figure it out. it's not magic, and it's probably different for everyone. I am certainly not the best at it. I've seen others that are much better than I in making sure you appreciate those that support you. It doesn't change the fact that you're gone a lot, you know, showing gratitude back for their sacrifice sometimes is all you can do.
As the director of the North Dakota Department of Emergency Services, how do you see their role as an asset to the state?
Well, they're at their best when others are having possibly their worst day ever. So, you know, the department is made up of state radio, who dispatches all first responders at the federal and state level, plus for 26 counties in North Dakota. Amazing people, tough work, it's shift work. It can be probably incredibly boring at times and then high stress. A couple of times a year, I think we give out stork pins where a dispatcher has to talk somebody through childbirth because they can't get to the hospital. Folks struggling with mental illness, folks under attack, somebody that's just been in an accident is injured, just incredibly stressful situations, and just a great team down there that, I mean, it knocks it out of the park. The other side of DES is Homeland Security. Most of that is really emergency management. You know, think fires, floods, pandemics, pipeline protests. That's the team that responds. I told them the other day, I think my best days as Adjutant General have been in the SEOC, the State Emergency Operations Center. There's just something about folks coming together, forming that team, again, generating options, operationalizing them, and making a difference. Whether it's getting a levee built quickly, putting water on a fire, dealing with a months-long protest, just something special about that. And, you know, and that's back to work-life balance. Have the right life partner, because that year I miss Thanksgiving, I miss Christmas, and it's not like I was overseas. I was in my house, but not really in my house. So those are very challenging times, but we got an incredible team in Homeland Security. And it's not just the response piece, it's the mitigation piece and the recovery piece. You know, those guys work behind the scenes. You know, usually when something makes the news about an emergency, it's the guard building a levee in Minot or putting out a fire in Medora, and it's the helicopter above the fold on the newspaper. Well, the team that makes sure that all that is resourced and gets on target when it's needed is the team over in Homeland Security of DES. But, you know, there's nothing really cool about that. So the helicopter gets in the newspaper, but all the hard work that went on in building 30 Afrain barracks, you know, hardly gets a mention. But great people, they have a mentality like a guardsman. I call it the rush to the fire mentality. Something's going on, you don't have to call them up and ask them to come in. They're self-deploying because they know they gotta get into work. They gotta get on the phone with the Corps of Engineers or the fire service or with local emergency managers, start generating options to support that local incident commander to get things under control, save lives, protect property. That's what they do every day.
When you first started your military career, did you think that you would be an adjutant general?
No, I didn't. When I went on active duty, it was I needed a job. Being an infantry platoon leader. But like every lieutenant in Germany, I bought a nice car, a nice stereo, a nice TV. I saved exactly zero money. So I thought, well, I better do another turn. So I stayed in, went to Okinawa for 3 years, actually managed to save some money. And again, as I said earlier, I liked the fun stuff out in the field. It didn't look like that was in my future anymore, so I'll go do something else. But it was when I came back to work for the Guard, you know, I didn't think I'd make major. When I made major, I'm like, okay. And then a full-time, I was a combat engineer at the time, but a full-time job opened up as a JAG officer. Applied for that when General Bjerke was the tag. He hired me, worked for him for a couple of years. And the first time I really thought about adjutant general was after General Bjerke retired. We were changing the tag appointment statute to ensure that any adjutant general that was appointed by the governor could be federally recognized as a general officer. Because before that, you could appoint, you know, a captain that hadn't been to captain's career course, much less war college, and make him or her the adjutant general. And he came back to testify on that bill. And in his testimony, he says, you know, we need to do this. And I was on my way to war college that next year. But General Bjerke said, we need to do this so guys like Major Dorman over here can be adjutant general someday. And I'm like, what? That never entered my mind. And General Bjerke was a great mentor. You can talk to a lot of people during his time as adjutant general, and they'll point to him as, you know, a key mentor in their life. You know, he made that statement. I applied for a DOD fellowship at Tufts University, which is a war college equivalent. And he got the announcement for that, came out to my office and said, you need to do this. And I'm like, oh, I'll never get in. And my wife was working in HRO at the time and walked down the hall and said, hey, General Bjerke said I should apply to this. It's in Boston. It would be for a year. We had two kids with a third on the way. It just sounded like a lot of work for her mainly. And I said, hey, I'm going to apply, but I doubt I'll get it. And of course, I got it. But, you know, General Bjerke's encouragement on that, you know, just kind of the off-the-cuff statement in front of a legislative committee that we got to do this so guys like this can be adjutant general someday. You know, I was like, well, maybe I could. And then, you know, the challenges, doing whatever is next, preparing yourself for whatever is next, because you may not get it, but at least somebody has to say no. They can't say no because you're not qualified. They got to say no because they don't think you're the right fit for the job. But I kept getting those scary opportunities, kept building the teams, doing the best I could so I could move on to the next scary opportunity. And by the time I went to Kosovo, was commanding general of a multinational battle group, I'm like, I think I could be adjutant general. I think I could do that.
What advice do you have for young service members just starting their military careers?
Challenge yourself. Like I said before, just prepare yourself for whatever's next. I didn't think I would be in the Army past my first tour in Germany. Didn't think I'd be, the only reason, well, not the only reason, one of the reasons I joined the Valley City unit when I was in law school is you can't work in law school. So I could get a little extra money on the side doing the guard thing, but that was going to be done as soon as I was done with law school. But when I got the uniform, put the uniform back on, I'm like, you know, I think this is what I'm supposed to do. And I think really fortunate I joined the National Guard because the path I took to Adjutant General is not typical. I've been an infantry signal JAG engineer officer during my career. I missed battalion command because that was the time I was a JAG officer, but then I got brigade command. And typically you don't get brigade command if you don't have battalion command. I got brigade command as a general officer, which you normally don't do either. I got to go to a war college fellowship at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy because they offered one slot nationwide for a JAG officer, and I happened to be a JAG officer at the time. I got there and I'm like, this is unbelievable. This is a school that I could not get into on my own merits, but because I'm in the military and they have these fellowship programs, I'm here at, you know, Tufts University. So, you know, challenge yourself, prepare yourself for what's next. You know, again, you need a supportive family, but when an opportunity comes up, to go do something that will make you a better guardsman, a better NCO officer, take those opportunities. My wife, God bless her, but I came back from Kosovo, and 3 months later, there was a notice that somebody dropped out of the Joint Combined Warfighters course, which is required for joint qualification certification. I had to leave in a week, and I'd only been home from Kosovo for 2 months. So I'm like, honey, do you mind if I leave for 10 weeks? And she says, if that's what you need to do, go do it. So it's, again, it's not gonna be the same for everyone, but you know, preparing yourself, continuing to look for those opportunities that scare you. If they do, do your homework so that you can get from, I don't know what I'm doing here to, you know, I did the work I need to do to prepare myself to execute. Prepare yourself and do what scares you, and you'll grow as a leader.
What are your plans after you retire?
Gonna go to the lake for a week. yeah, I get asked that a lot. Not gonna travel the world, and I've already traveled the world. I don't really like to do that much, but I will do it some because my wife likes to travel. And she's going to work for a couple more years, so take some time off. They always tell you to take like months off. I don't think I can handle that, but we'll take some time off and then figure out what's next.
And that wraps up our interview with Major General Alan Dorman. I cannot begin to echo more or just say more how much of an honor and a privilege it was to ask you some of these questions. And then also just listen. It was an honor and a privilege. Congratulations on retirement if you're listening out there. And with that, everyone, we hope you enjoyed the episode, and we'll catch you next time.